Because the sun isn't real far.
And the rear wheel of the armoured car went over a mine, and the armoured car was lifted onto the... Well, the back of the armoured car was lifted onto the back of the jeep. And the sapper driver woke up in considerable alarm. The subaltern wasn't too bad. We got him out of thing, but the driver was in a bad way because he was trapped inside the armoured car. Fortunately, it didn't go on fire or anything. But it was obviously going to be quite a job to cut him out. But it was anyone seeing it would say, well, how utterly ridiculous this is! How could anyone be so stupid? But you've got very uncompromising sort of orders about going on. And at the same time, a lot of people were terribly tired. And if you're terribly tired, you do rather stupid things. Quite unnecessary, very stupid. Attack. We went in, must have been the 6th of August, the 6th of August, yes, the evening of the 6th of August. Went down the river. Wading the river wasn't difficult, it was only about that deep.
Just over your knees.
Into a sort of re-entrant on the other side, which had been taken for us by the South Staffs. And one or two wounded coming down. There was a certain amount of mortar fire. I remember my platoon sergeant saying, don't move so fast. And I said, well, the faster you move, the quicker you'll get clear of this mortaring. The thing about all heavy weapons of that nature, as my father pointed out from the First War, that the closer you get to the enemy, the less willing he is to use his heavy weapons, because he may hit himself. My father also said that he'd been up in the Ypres salient in 1915. He said the safest trench was the one that was actually only 15 yards from the enemy. They daren't use their... That was at a time when the German artillery was sort of 5-1 against us. He said that they daren't... That the trenches were so close together that the Germans daren't use their artillery on our trench at that point. Yes, well, we moved up this gully, which was at right angles to the River Orne, and formed up, lining this gully on facing south towards Thury Harcourt. And John had told Dougie and I that the company would keep moving forward towards its objective so long as the three officers kept moving in the right direction. And so our formation must have been rather similar, I should think, to the Battle of the Somme. My platoon was on the left, Dougie's was on the right, and John, the company commander, was in the middle. And I had two sections up and one section behind, and I suppose Dougie had the same. And presumably there was a reserve platoon following John. Now, the thing that strikes me now, is the... Our means of communication were no better than certainly the First War or virtually any other war that went before. There were wireless sets. Simple idea that the number 36 comes to mind. But these wireless sets were heavy and they had a 12-foot copper aerial that you put together. And quite simply, nobody would carry them into action. John, this is the company commander, John Towers, had a set somewhere. I imagine it was sort of carried at the back of the company. But our means of communication were purely by whistles and waving arms. It's simply no, and no advance on the First War that I'm aware of. At Okchu and in the Herefords and so on, I acquired the very minimal knowledge of wireless or of wireless procedure. All I know is that when you finish saying what you've got to say, you say out, and if you're expecting an answer, you say over, and that's it. Other arms, of course, like the artillery and the cavalry, of course, their wirelesses worked and so on. But in the infantry, in my experience, they didn't. I was fortunate in that, in fact, I think the whole company was fortunate. As we advanced, I remember one of my corporals saying to me, "Watch the trees, sir, watch the trees." Well, I watch the trees. He was thinking of snipers, I suppose. And I remember him, the reason I'm sure why he was saying watch the trees is because his steel helmet had a nasty dent in the front of it, which I think had been caused by a sniper in some previous battle. It hit the front of his steel helmet. He was very conscious, these fellows. And I remember saying, "I can't do it. You watch the trees for me." Well, things went all right until I saw there was a little copse to my left. And I was supposed to detach a section in case there was a sniper in it. I'm afraid I had to disregard that order. I thought, had there been a sniper, I would have dealt with him. But really, one must maintain the impetus of an advance, and it's not the duty of the leading platoons to sort of worry about things on the flank. Well, I ignored that instruction. Another instruction we'd received, which I think was, which was a pity one wasn't able to discuss orders, was that we should carry with us ammunition for the 3-inch mortars. Now, as we were crossing a river, which tanks could not cross, it would be much more prudent if we'd going to carry additional ammunition if we'd carried spare bombs for our Piats, projector infantry anti-tank. But no, we were told to carry 3-inch mortar bombs. Well, anyway, we dumped them on our start line. We obviously weren't going to advance the objective for these things. I hope they proved useful later on. We came to a very thick hedge, the sort of hedge you can't burst your way through, and it had an ominous gap in it. And as we approached this gap, a Boche sort of darted across the gap. Well, we all had a whack at him. I didn't carry a Sten gun, I carried a rifle and fired this thing from the hip. I think he got away with it and didn't get him. So the platoon sort of halted, and it was very obvious that the first man to go through the gap had got to be me. So I darted through the gap, sort of rather hoping there wasn't a shoe mine in it. And when I got to the other side of the gap, it was a large German earthwork. And the Germans not only sort of dig down, but they make a great pile of earth, a tremendous sort of head cover. So I fired a shot into the entrance of this, what appeared to be the entrance of this great earthwork. And two very sort of tired-looking Bosch came out, one of them with a little sort of handkerchief in his hand, and a man behind me said, "Can I take him to the rear, sir?" And I said, "Oh yes, all right." I suppose I ought really to have rolled a grenade or something to see whether there were any more Bosch in this thing. I'm afraid I thought we better get going, so we went on. Now, again, if I digress a moment, no one, any of my octaves or trainees, had ever mentioned the problem of prisoners. at Okju and battle schools and so on, intention to kill the enemy at A or B or C, as the case might be, never dealt with the problem either of what's of our wounded or the enemy's prisoners. Obviously, wounded ideally should be left to people coming from the rear, and you should continue your advance. But it won't always happen that way when you've got great friends and one of them gets knocked down. None of these things had been dealt with, and I think the problem was that we were not trained by people who had experience of action. I mean, I assumed that the chap behind me who said, "Can I take them to the rear, sir?" was perhaps one of our less useful soldiers who was longing to, you know, not be at the front, probably just the right man to take them to the rear. Well, we got on. That was the only incident in that advance. I'm not aware that the rest of the company had any further problems. It was getting quite dark by then, and about just before we reached our objective, without any further opposition, I met Wally Elsie, who was mentioned in that little pamphlet I've given you, who was an old Hereford's officer, and he told me that Harry Fox, his platoon had run into trouble and Harry had been killed. Our objective was in a little bit of an orchard, and by the time we got there, the enemy had gone. By then it was dark, and as events proved, we dug in the wrong place. If you find holes in the ground on the objective, I suppose it's not unnatural to improve those holes. But of course, holes which are dug with a field of fire in one direction have not necessarily got a good field of fire in another direction. And I found in the morning, when the light came, and the enemy came with them, that in fact where we dug in, we were not only in an orchard, but also there was a lot of corn, and in consequence the enemy was able to get fairly close to us undetected. And we started an infantry battle. I don't know really what the strength of the enemy was. If it was just a fighting patrol, it was a very strong one. And there were chaps sort of creeping around in the corn. They were, I felt, better soldiers than we were. There was a sort of confidence about these Germans. They would call out, I can't remember exactly, but sort of things like, "Come on, Tommy, you've had it," you know, that sort of thing, And so the old North staff says, "Fuck off!" and naturally to be greeted by a brrr from a Spandau, you see. Presumably, if you try and shoot back from where the Boche has called at you, he's presumably moved on a bit. And I remember not being quite sure what the attention of these fellows was. So I thought, well, I wonder if they're really trying, this is really an attack. So I told everyone to fix bayonets. And one chap was getting a bit, he said, one of my weapon pits complained that there was a Boche vein there. So I said, well, you know, try a 36 grenade. And he did, and that seemed to sort of remove, whether it killed him or not, I don't know, it sort of removed the problem. I was astonished at the quantity of ammunition that the Germans seemed to have at their disposal. You're familiar with the British automatic weapon, you know, the Johnny get your gun, Johnny get your gun, Johnny get your gun, the sort of three or four, the Bren gun, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Whereas the, in a fairly sort of steady rate of fire, and you can hold a Bren gun on its target, it's a lovely, reliable weapon, the Bren gun. The Spandau, I never fired one, but the impression, and the bullets come out and out, torrent, brrr, 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 and then the bursts are sort of 10 or 15 rounds at a go. And I would think that they must be quite difficult to hold a weapon with that rate of fire on the target. And I did actually notice that morning that there's quite a lot, the Germans were using a proportionate tracer, and that this tracer was going very high. Now, whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know. I mean, you can imagine somebody, one gun firing tracer high, and another gun making you feel to feel safe, and another gun firing tracer at ground level. Not firing tracer. Again, this they could have been firing deliberately high so that their own people could move in underneath that fire and try and grab someone. They may have been after a prisoner. I don't know. Anyway, we were plagued by these fellows with their Spandaus creeping about in the corner. And one particular chap I couldn't get a shot at. So I went back to the mortar pit and I tried. The chap I was after was only about less than 100 yards away. So when I fired this 2-inch mortar bomb, it had to go up almost perpendicular. And I fired it myself, and it went very much over to the right. I think it was due to, I think the 2-inch mortar has there were two models. One had a lever which operated the firing mechanism, and the other had a wheel. And I think this was the one with a wheel. It didn't give you the leverage that the lever had given you. And I think this mortar had not been properly maintained. And I think in the process of twisting the wheel, I must have turned the thing over to the right. Anyway, I remember the bomb falling not where I'd intended at all. And I turned round to the mortar man, said, "Give me another bomb." And I was stupid of me because I looked up to see where the bomb had fallen. As I didn't duck down again, and I felt a bullet go in my back. And it was wasn't painful. It was like someone sort of putting a sort of warm needle into one's back. And but I knew I'd been hit. And I remember between someone, "You've been hit, sir." And I said, "Yes." And I gave my watch, my binoculars, and my map, platoon sergeant, and the mortar man very prudently said, "Can I have your pistol, sir?" And I said, "Yes." Because one of the curious things about British Army, the poor old mortar man, he had his mortar, you know, not exactly as a personal weapon, pretty well useless. He wasn't equipped with a pistol. So I gave him his pistol and the 12 rounds with which an officer was allowed to. That's why no British, very, very few British officers could shoot with their pistol because they never had any ammunition to practice with. Had 12 rounds. And so I gave him my pistol, and I began to get, breathing wasn't so easy. And I did remember one useful thing I'd learnt from one of those army pamphlets, that if you're wounded in the chest, lie on the bad side. Otherwise, you can drown your good lung with the blood from your wounded lung. So I remembered that one, lie on the bad side. Well, not long after that, in order to sort the situation out, John, the company commander, brought down our artillery, if not on my position, very, very close to it. And that cleared the enemy out. Good shooting. So far as I know, well, certainly with no casualties in my platoon. Now, how John knew I'd been wounded, I don't know. But I got a message. A message came up saying, get out now. So I staggered off to Company HQ. Staggered's a bit wrong, but I walked not very strongly because I was sort of using any one lung. And there I found Dougie had been wounded. He'd got a hole in his ankle. And John was looking very debonair. He'd been wounded in the arm, I think, and he'd sort of got a... He's a very handsome, blonde chap, I think a great... Oh, dear. Success with the women. And he looked very sort of soldierly with a... What do you call it? A sling round his arm. You know. From there, I was escorted to some sort of vehicle. And I suppose a jeep. And off we went to the rear. One thing did impress me was that the sappers had made a bridge, which at least would take a jeep. I don't know whether it would take a tank, during the night. And the Orn, well, it's a jolly sight wider than the Kennet. I mean, all this fuss we have here in Tilbury about, oh, you know, sort of improvements to bridges or rebuilding of bridges or something in Newbury. Oh, God bless my soul. I mean, a Bailey Bridge would have been put across that, as I say, overnight. Just how wide the Orne was. I know. Anyway, it's wider than, certainly wider than the Kennet at Newbury. Once one was kept on putting morphia into one, which kept one sort of reasonably sort of gaga, and it seemed to take hours to get to hospital. I think the system with sort of medical side is that you take your casualties from one place to another. They take a look at him. They say, oh, he'll live till he gets the next one. They probably deduct the most urgent cases. You see. So, and as I wasn't very urgent, I got right back to some sort of base hospital outside Bayeux, and where I was operated on. And I don't know how many, probably looking here, I was able to sort of write a letter on my knees within a matter of days to my parents, sort of saying how I was. And I wrote a letter, I remember writing a letter for another chap. Oh dear. His name, yes, I know, a chap called Elgar. He was in one of the rifle regiments. And now, why couldn't he write for himself? Anyway, he couldn't, so I wrote a letter for him too. And for reasons that quite understand, I spent about a fortnight in that hospital. Most people sort of were evacuated in a matter of days. While I was there, there's a rather interesting chap. He was had been a regular soldier, was a squadron commander in some cavalry regiment, and he'd been wounded for the second time in Normandy, not very seriously, I think, the arm. They wanted to send him home to sort of convalesce. And he said, no, I don't want to go home. Can't you find a nice beach for me somewhere in Normandy? And I talked to him about this and his career. And he said, well, I was in, he was in 7th Armoured, you know, Desert Rats. And he said, well, of course, when we came back from Italy, I saw England in wartime. He said, I didn't like what I saw at all. You see, I left England about 1935 and in the army. And while we were out in Egypt in the army, this is before the war, I left the regiment, presumably he's a short service commissioner, and went to work for the British Petroleum or the Iraq, one of the petrol companies up the Gulf. When the war broke out and his regiment was in Egypt, were very anxious to have him back, and he was very anxious to get back. So he fought through the desert and into Italy with his regiment, and he'd had this disagreeable experience of coming home in the middle of the war and finding England extremely dull and blacked out, disagreeable. And he said, I've no wish to go back there. He said, I want, as soon as I'm properly patched up, I don't mind a few days rest somewhere. I want to rejoin my regiment, which, well, I feel at home. But the last thing I want to do is go back to England. It's a nice sort of approach to service life. I don't know what his name was. Well, then we had a wonderful channel crossing. I'd never, ever been so smooth in some vast thing. I suppose from, I don't know, Wistreham or somewhere like that. I don't know where it went. So we finished up in Southampton, and after a night there, they put us into cattle trucks with some delightful girls called nursing auxiliaries. And I must say, they were very nice girls. I don't know how they knew very much about nursing, but they were very jolly. And nicknamed Naughty Angels, N.A. I remember someone prudently kicked some of the woodwork out of this cattle truck. So we got a little bit of air came in. And there were nice bunks and so on, but there were no windows to this thing. And they got me up to Nottingham. When you got to Nottingham, they said there was a bit of bullet that hadn't been extracted, so they wanted to take that out. And I remember saying, oh, no, there's no bullet left in there. I said, there's something wrong with the negative. They took me so seriously, they actually took another photograph. Said, well, the same thing's come out again. I said, oh, right, you win. The reason why there was a bit there, I've lost the bullet now, I had it at one time, was that the bullet that hit me must have been a ricochet, because the bit that they cut out of me, it was the what's called the envelope of the bullet, the sort of outside bit, it actually had a bit of my uniform tucked into it. It must have been distorted when it went in. And the bit that had to be chopped out in Nottingham was the core of the bullet, which was presumably penetrated further, you see. As I've been hit in the back, this bit had sort of gotten nearer to the front, so they chopped that out. But, and then I... now, wait a minute. I think they didn't do that in Nottingham. They probably did it at Leicester, was the place which was sort of specialised in chest things. So I think I went down to Leicester and was probably operated on there. And then after a certain amount of time at Leicester, I went to a very nice convalescent place outside Ringwood, where there was very good coarse fishing. Ibsley belonged to some pier. Anyway, doesn't matter. But it was on the Avon. And from there I went home. Now, this was a curious business. I was at home from October 1944 until February 1944.